I'm Alan Combs. I want to welcome Dr. Arun Kudnani. He is an adjunct professor at NYU. Among other venues where he teaches, he has written The Muslims Are Coming. And I wonder what led to this, because, you know, since 9/11, we have such an attitude in this country about Muslims. This really parses all the bigotry, the hatred, the things that happen in this country. Tell me what led to this particular book.
Well, thanks for having me on Fox.
Sure.
It's a pleasure. So, you know, I'm interested in civil rights issues. And for me, one of the biggest, if not the biggest kind of civil rights issue we have right now in the United States is the Islamophobia that we have, the kind of institutional ways that Muslims aren't enjoying their full civil rights right now.
Did this become more institutional after 9/11, or was it significantly better prior to that?
You know, I think the some of the kind of attitudes were certainly around before 9/11. But what happened after 9/11 was a whole set of policies and practices that brought those attitudes into the government and made them a part of the way the government operates.
For example, the New York City Police Department, in conjunction
right.
with the feds, have poured millions of dollars into monitoring, spying on Muslims, going to bookstores, going to mosques. This is what this country has come down to.
Right, right. So the New York Police Department have implemented a program over the last decade or so where they have systematically put informants in mosques, in student associations, right. in cafes, in businesses. And what they're doing is they're collecting information not about potential crimes, but about people's religious and political opinions, right?
Right.
And we know from some of the court processes around this that actually all of that surveillance generated no criminal leads at all, right?
Give me an example of some of the people you mentioned in your book. Tell me about them, like Jamil Scott, for example.
Right. So the story of Jamil Scott, he's actually based in Manchester, England, right? So part,
right.
So
part
of the book is actually also on what happens in Britain, where you have a similar kind of picture. But so Jamil Scott is a guy who joins a kind of peaceful political protest against the Israeli deputy ambassador who's giving a lecture at a university in Manchester. And he, as a result of participating in that, he's a 17-year-old school kid.
Right.
He's not committed any crime, but he's subjected to a kind of program that the police have to attempt to depoliticize him, to put all kinds of pressure on him to stop him from participating in the political process.
Tell me about Imam Lugman.
So Imam Lugman was an African-American Muslim who was a preacher in Detroit. Again, someone who had strong political opinions. He was very critical of the American government. But he was never involved in any kind of terrorist activity of any kind. The FBI put some informants in his mosque and attempted to entrap him into a kind of criminal conspiracy that they invented. And in the raid that they did on the warehouse where they'd placed him, he actually ended up getting shot and killed.
So there's this bigotry among our authorities if you have a Muslim name.
I mean, what I think you have is a kind of set of practices in government and a set of ways of thinking in government that assume that if you're a Muslim, then you, just for that reason alone, you need to be singled out for extra surveillance, that you're in some way a potential terrorist.
And they'll say, well, you know, everybody who commits terror, not all Muslims commit terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims, which is not true.
Right. That's the kind of cliche that circulates. It's not true. The statistics paint a very different picture.
What did you learn statistically that's in the book? What did you learn in terms of what we need to know?
The most striking thing on the statistics is, you know, we have this vast apparatus of surveillance of Muslim Americans and Muslims who are permanent residents of America on the assumption that they are a threat of terrorism. And if you look at the statistics on terrorism over the last 20 years within the United States, more people have been killed in cases of far-right extremism than cases involving Muslim Americans.
One of the things that even liberals have been on the wrong side of this issue, right, as you point out in the
absolutely,
book.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm a progressive. I'm a liberal. I embrace the L word. And I'm embarrassed that some people on my side of the political plate have been as bigoted as I would expect those who disagree with me to be.
Right. And I think one of the problems that liberals have had is around an assumption that religious belief is what causes terrorism, right? Because, you know, a lot of liberals are kind of hardcore secularists, and so they've assumed that religious belief must be what lies behind this.
But they may, some of them may be against all religion, but yes.
Right.
But that, you're saying it's not religious belief that drives the radicals.
Right, and this is one of the big myths that I think has taken hold after 9/11 is we've looked at terrorism, we've thought, okay, that must be something that's caused by Islam and by religious belief.
How do you then uncouple the two, that it's not the religion itself that causes it? So
well,
where
it's so, you know, if we want to understand what causes terrorism, which is a good idea, if we want to reduce terrorism, we should try and analyze it
good
and understand
idea.
What causes
yeah.
it rather than just kind of, you know, say it's this evil thing out there.
Yeah.
We need to look at politics rather than religion, right?
Right?
We need to look at the political contexts in different parts of the world out of which terrorism emerges. It's nothing to do with the religion. You know, take a look at Hamas, for example. Hamas uses the language of religion to legitimize its violence, but it also uses the language of religion to legitimize its ceasefires. So it's not the religious part of it that's driving its decision to use violence or not at a particular time. It's the political context within it.
You will hear people say things like, look at all these Muslim countries. They're all violent. They're all repressive of women. They're all this or all that. But it's the political system there. Is there a Muslim country that's peaceful, that doesn't have some of the bad actions of countries where you have repression?
Well, I think the question is where we see violence around the world, or where we see oppression of women around the world. We need to try and work out what's causing that. And you know, when you study it and look at it objectively, it's not because you have this bad religion out there that's causing that. It's the ways that people try and instrumentalize religion for political purposes, right? And the reason that there's a particular history in Palestine of the use of political violence is inseparable from the history of Israel's military occupation of Palestine, right? So it's convenient for us to think, well, it must be because we think Palestinians are Muslims, but it's more to do with that kind of history of that conflict.
You also say that what we call extremism are often the result of our own actions, our own wars.
Right. So if you look at you know, what terrorists themselves say about why they're committing acts of terrorism, which isn't, you know, the only thing that we can look at to try and understand
it's
the causes here, but it might be useful to kind of see what they themselves say. And what they tend to talk about is our foreign policy, the things like drone strikes, things like the wars that we've carried out.
It's not because we're free. You know, we heard that after 9/11. Oh, they don't like us because we're free. No, they don't like us because we go into their countries.
Right. It's, you know, I mean, I think it's part of the story here is the war in Iraq, which has generated anger and a lot of frustration. Part of the story is the drone strikes that we've been carrying out in Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen. We backed an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia, which is a big part of why a lot of Somalis joined al-Shabaab. And we've backed authoritarian regimes in Egypt, in Pakistan.
Do you think 9/11 would not have happened had we had a different foreign policy?
Without a doubt. I mean, I think if our foreign policy in the Middle East was a policy of genuinely supporting the emancipation of those people, and we hadn't backed authoritarian regimes, and we'd had a different approach to Israel-Palestine, I think we would have avoided 9/11.
We're going to come back in a moment. The Muslims Are Coming is the book. And by the way, you've got an appearance coming up in New York this Thursday, downtown at the Elwan for the arts. And if they go to your website, which is let me spell it, kundani.org, KUNDNANI.org. There's all the information about where exactly that's going to be at 7 o'clock in New York this Thursday night. Your book launch and discussion about this. I'm Alan Combs. We're talking with Arun Kundnani. He is an adjunct professor at NYU. His book is called The Muslims Are Coming. I want to get further into this issue of what the NYPD did, New York Police Department, in looking into Muslims, literally spying on them. Tell me about Shamir Rahman.
Right. So Rahman was a kid who
recruited by the...
So he was arrested on a kind of marijuana possession charge, had a small amount of pot on him.
Right.
And the NYPD basically did a deal with him where they said... Work as an informant for us and spend some time in Muslim student associations and tell us what everyone's saying, what are the political opinions that people have, what are the religious opinions that the people have. And he did this for a little while. He was getting paid every month. And then eventually he said, you know, I don't believe that this is right because no one here is committing any crimes. No one was ever going to commit any crimes. These are law-abiding people. The only suspicion is based on the fact that they're Muslim, right? And so the Associated Press had an investigation that won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago, kind of exposing what the New York Police Department were up to.
The religion of Islam is, you call it, a peaceful religion, a benign religion,
well,
correct?
You know, my take on this, you know, since 9/11, we've had this kind of debate go on between liberals and conservatives,
right,
where conservatives kind of say, you know, Islam is a violent religion, or it's a religion that's incompatible with democracy, or it's incompatible with modernity. And then liberals kind of come back and say, no, actually, Islam is a religion of peace. And this kind of goes on and on and on.
Right.
And everyone's trading these quotations from the Quran. And actually, you never really get anywhere, right?
Yeah,
and
they do that with the Bible, too. But
right,
yeah.
Right. And the problem here is that both sides are assuming that, you know, that Islam is one thing. Right. And actually, you know, if you take 1 million Muslims, you'll have 1,000 different interpretations of what Islam means. And it, you know, provides a kind of broad moral framework. But within that, whether you think that, you know, what its meanings are in terms of a question like, should you use violence, is going to depend on who you are and what your context is, rather than anything inherent
to
Islam.
You could say the same thing about Christianity. There are people who, in the name of Jesus, go after abortion doctors. And,
of course.
They're radical Christians.
That's the thing. You know, when we think about Muslims and we find a Muslim who's done something bad, we assume straight away that it's because of Islam, right? If we see a Christian do something bad, we say, oh, okay, that person was a bad individual. Maybe they had some mental health issues.
Sure.
But, you know, in the same way, Christianity can be used for all kinds of different political purposes. You know, you see the Westboro Baptist Church who think that Christianity teaches hatred of gays.
Well, yeah. And then you see, they're only a couple of hundred. Now they're down to about 20 people.
Right, I mean, right,
yeah,
right. But, you know, there's a number
of
people who believe that Christianity forbids homosexuality. There's also Christians who think that Christianity allows you to be gay, right? There's the Wheaton College folks who say that, right? So, again, it's the same sort of thing.
Oppression and poverty are two things you discuss as well in terms of what we need to do to correct those who are disempowered in this world, who may not go the radical route if they had better opportunity, right?
Right. I mean, I think terrorism for me ultimately is a symptom of political impotence. And so if you look at history, wherever you see terrorism, you see some kind of wider political context where people have been disempowered, right? So the more that we can empower people to feel that they can participate in the political process, to feel that they have equal rights, the more we're going to achieve in terms of actually reducing the risk of terrorism.
Was Osama bin Laden, though, politically disempowered?
No, well, bin Laden comes from, you know, one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. His story is not a story of poverty. I don't think this is really about poverty, but I think it's about the wider political context. So in the Middle East, you know, you had a situation for decades where, you know, any government that was, you know, all the most repressive governments in terms of democratic rights were the ones that the US was backing, right? We backed the Saudi regime. The Saudi regime is the only country in the world, you know, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where the country is named after a ruling elite, right? The Saudis, right?
Yeah.
It would be like America being called, you know, the United States of Bush, right? So those are
some people think that's what it might be, especially Jeb runs
again. Right, exactly, right. So, and they're our best friends in the Middle East, right? So we're kind of, you know, an anti-democratic force. And that's what lies behind this.
We have to radically change our political thinking in this country and foreign policy if we're really going to make the kind of changes that would not attract terrorism. And I don't see that happening anytime
soon.
Right.
Well, I think the problem we have is ultimately what this boils down to is, you know, we have a narrow elite in this country, the rich and the powerful, the 1%, whatever you want to call them. And part of their power and wealth comes from running a global empire, right? And if you're going to run a global empire, you need to find some way to justify doing that. And so it's nice to be able to say, well, you know, there's all these threats out there. There's this scary thing called Islam. And you distract the population from the reality of their power.
How do we? Your book is so important because it educates people about what really is going on. But on a broader scale, how do we educate the American populace about that it's not about Islam, it's not about a religion, it's about a different mindset, and that we have contributed to that because of our actions? That's a hard nut to sell.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the starting point for me is, you know,
hard nut to crack. I think I mixed my metaphors there.
You know, I think the starting point for me is we need to start to understand that, you know, we have over 2 million Muslims in America who are our fellow citizens.
Yeah.
And their stories of being on the receiving end of the kinds of surveillance that we have and the kinds of government policies that we have that violate their civil rights. We need to start hearing those stories, right?
And they're not all plotting to overthrow the United States or bring Sharia law to this country.
No, right. And, you know, we have to get beyond these kind of conspiracy theories as well, right? So we have this, you know, if you look at, you know, Islamophobia works in some similar ways to anti-Semitism, right? So you look at the history of anti-Semitism in the 20th century, it was all about conspiracy theories. There's some secret group of Jews controlling the world. Well, now we're doing the same thing with Muslims, right? So the most powerful man in the world is secretly a Muslim who's trying to impose Sharia law on America, right? It's exactly the same structure. So we need to get away from these conspiracy theories, start hearing the stories of our fellow citizens who happen to be Muslim and understanding their experience in their lives.
Some of these people are the same people who had a witness, or at least their ancestor did, Irish Catholic need not apply in this country years ago.
Right, absolutely.
And they're doing the same thing to another group that may be coming more into this country. It's one of the fastest growing populations, the Islamic population.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, in many ways, it is just another very American story about, you know, the current group of immigrants who are coming in, and their stories will resemble, you know, the stories of Irish Americans, the stories of Jews in the 20th century. So, yeah, absolutely. It's part of that same thing.
I asked you this off the air before, and our audience may want to know. They may presume you're Muslim because of your name, but you're not.
No, right? I'm an atheist.
Yeah. Were you raised in a particular religious tradition?
My father's a Hindu and my mother's a Catholic.
I see. That's interesting.
So, neither of them were particularly religious.
But you're not an angry atheist. You're not someone going, I want everybody to stop believing in God. That's crazy. You're not one of those guys.
No, right? I have a lot of respect for religious belief. I certainly don't think that I have some kind of intellectual superiority because of my atheism, which is how a lot of atheists are. So, absolutely.
Is there any action you'd like your book to inspire people to do? Is there anything you'd like to see as a result of having written this?
You know, I think the first thing I would hope is that we start talking about our fellow citizens who happen to be Muslim in a different way. We start hearing their stories, hearing their experiences. And then I think that's the basis to go on and say, let's start questioning some of these surveillance policies in particular, right? So, you know, we have had this debate over the last year or so following Edward Snowden's whistleblowing about the surveillance that we have. And that's great. But actually, when you ask, like, who is actually on the receiving end of mass surveillance, warrantless surveillance in the United States, who's having their Fourth Amendment rights most violated? It is actually Muslim Americans. So let's start engaging with that issue in that way.
It's not the old white Christian guy who is most put upon in this country. It's even atheists. There's only one atheist in Congress, Pete Stark, that I know of in California.
Right. So, absolutely.
Anyway, the book is called The Muslims Are Coming. And if you go to kudnani.org, KUNDNANI.org, you can find out about Arun's appearances, including one this Thursday night in Lower Manhattan. We'll be talking about the very issues we're talking about here. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it very much.